You're listening to Crossings Radio, a production of the University of Oregon UNESCO Crossings Institute. I'm Jonathan Bach. That's the Vimbuza, an African dance and a piece of so-called intangible cultural heritage, the subject of today's talk. Today we're in the studio with Lisa Gilman. Lisa is an associate professor for the University of Oregon Folklore Program. She's also the co-editor of UNESCO On the Ground, Local Perspectives on Global Policy for Intangible Cultural Heritage. So this is a book about the effects of UNESCO, which is the United Nations educational, scientific, and cultural organizations, and its policies at the level of the communities with which it associates. The locales covered in this collection of essays stretch from Macedonia to Japan to Malawi. And you yourself actually worked to study the Vimbuza dance in Malawi, which we'll get to in a second. But I'm kind of curious, I mean, right there in the titles of phrase folks might not be familiar with off the bat, and that's intangible cultural heritage. So what does that mean?
So intangible cultural heritage, I could read you the definition from UNESCO, and then I'll try to explain what it is. So in the 2003 Convention for the Safeguarding of the Intangible Cultural Heritage Convention, UNESCO, it's defined as, quote, the practices, representations, expressions, knowledge, skills, as well as the instruments, objects, artifacts, and cultural spaces associated therewith that communities, groups, and in some cases, individuals recognize as part of their cultural heritage. So basically, this concept came up as following their efforts to safeguard World Heritage sites, so recognizing kind of physical environments, both environmental sites as well as important historical or cultural places that were part of the heritage.
And so we just actually saw an example of a couple. I mean, I know a couple examples. There's some in Ukraine, some in Africa. Palmyra, I believe, was a World Heritage Site. Correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. But what's kind of what are other examples of these World Heritage Sites?
The intangible cultural heritage sites are specifically not that, right?
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
So you have the physical heritage sites, but what was missing from that is recognizing that the cultural stuff that people engage with, a lot of the more ephemeral stuff, so the music, the dance, the storytelling, the food, the customs around different traditions, marriage, funerals, all of that is really integral to human existence. And so all these efforts to kind of recognize physical places was missing all of this other stuff that is much more abstract and not tangible, hence
it's stuff
the term
that kind of
intangible
exists
cultural
in the
heritage.
Collective unconscious, as it were.
It exists within communities, usually in pretty tangible, recognizable ways within communities, but it's much harder to safeguard something that happens that people do as opposed to safeguarding a physical place where you can put effort to make sure that nobody destroys it or to bolster a physical structure or something. Mm-hmm. So the other piece of it was that a lot of the physical heritage sites are very much intricately intertwined with local culture, but the emphasis had been put on the places themselves without recognizing that the physical thing and the cultural stuff around it were all very intricately tied together, needed to be thought of together. So they use this idea of these heritage sites as a starting point for thinking about doing something similar with what they're calling intangible cultural heritage. Mm-hmm. And so these lists that there's kind of a history that led up to the 2003 convention, but as it stands now, what they're doing is encouraging their people who have signed on to the convention that they're mandated to, like if a country signs on to the convention, then it mandates them to do something to safeguard the cultural heritage in the country. And then there's a process that countries go through to submit applications for particular cultural practices to be designated as representative for the country and put onto this UNESCO list. So what our volume does is look at that process. It's an interesting process because if you think about any country, there's like a gazillion different cultural practices that happen in that country. And if you have countries that are very geographically diverse and culturally diverse, a lot of different groups of people across space are doing different kinds of things. And so how does one determine that three cultural practices out of a gazillion should be the ones on the UNESCO list? So that's kind of one of the starting points for this project.
And so where did it evolve from there? I mean, and how did you and Michael Dillon Foster conceptualize this book?
Yeah, so I can tell you from my perspective, I've been doing research in Malawi since I first went to Malawi in 1995. So it's been over the course of 20 years. And I do research on cultural forms in Malawi, a lot of musical and dance forms. And one of the steps that led me to this project were that I was hearing a lot from people at the grassroots level. So what we're calling people on the ground, people were really decrying the fact that, you know, our culture is dying, we're losing culture. And I study culture. I know that culture never dies, but culture changes, right? But when people say we're really concerned our culture is dying, they're concerned about something. And so I was really curious about what is it that they're concerned about? What is the cultural changes that are taking place that make them feel that there's some kind of negative repercussions? And so at the same time that I was hearing people on the ground saying that, I was aware that the country was involved with the UNESCO convention and had signed on to it. And so then I was really curious. I'm like, well, if people on the ground are saying, hey, our culture is dying, and then UNESCO is saying, hey, we need to safeguard culture, are they talking about the same thing? Mm-hmm. They're just kind of international effort, and then it gets worked through the nation state. So UNESCO is working with particular countries, their governments, to say, hey, you need to safeguard your culture. Mm-hmm. And so I was really curious about the relationship between what people were concerned about, you know, on the so-called ground versus what UNESCO was saying and then what the government was doing as the one mandated to actually do something about it.
And so did you find disparities between kind of what people on the ground, as you were saying, wanted, mm-hmm. and that which the government was enacting? I mean, what?
Yeah, so there's complete disparities. So in the Malawi case, what I found was that the relationship between those two things is very, first of all, most people on the ground have no idea that UNESCO exists. And maybe I can just kind of continue with how the project started. So I was really interested in those questions. And then I looked on the UNESCO list and I saw that there were two dance forms on the UNESCO mm-hmm. list, which immediately raised the question for me is, how did that happen? Like, why those two dance forms? Out of all of the dance forms in the country, how did those two end up? And what's being done to safeguard them? And do people even care about these dances? Or kind of the kinds of questions that led me to this. So at the same time that I was interested in these questions, I had a conversation with my colleague, Michael Dillon Foster, who does research in Japan. And he was similarly looking at the impacts in these tiny kind of archipelago of islands in Japan where an item had been inscribed on the list. And in that case, it was much more, the people on the ground were much happier and knowledgeable about what had happened. So we saw that there were some real differences in our two cases. And so that led us to think, oh, it'd be really interesting to bring together a group of scholars mm-hmm. who are working in different parts of the world to kind of start to see what's going on the ground and hopefully come up with a pretty complicated story, right? There's not just one thing going on. And mm-hmm. so each of the case studies in the book are looking at these very specific situations where, for most of it, where an item has been inscribed on a list and looking at what that process was and what it means to the people on the ground. And then we have discussants who are then looking at these six cases together and then trying to say something broader about UNESCO and the Intangible Cultural Heritage mm-hmm. Convention.
And so a couple of questions raise up from then. First off, as you were gathering in these reports from the different authors, I mean, what starts to surprise you about the trends you saw, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were, I don't know about surprises, but I think, you know, those of us who do work at that kind of ethnographic grassroots level are pretty used to, are really interested in thinking about, you know, and are aware of the vast gaps between kind of everyday people and the policies and strategies that exist to try to serve those people, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's usually such a disparity between those two things. And so, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things we found is that in a lot of places, people, even though their cultural form was on the UNESCO list, had never heard of UNESCO. And if they did, they had very little awareness of it. Though in a few cases, they did know that. And it was like this really big thing of like, hey, our cultural form is internationally recognized and that must make it really important. We should continue doing this. In other cases, people didn't know. And so it didn't really have that same impact.
Mm-hmm. And that, did you find that there was some kind of, I mean, was there some kind of power dynamic between UNESCO? I mean, it's enacting these global policies, mm-hmm. and it's kind of putting them upon the cultures. Was there, what were the benefits for the folks on the ground, if any? Or
mm-hmm. Well, one of our discussants, Tony Seeger, who's a famous ethnomusicologist and folklorist, he'd been really involved with the process, with establishing the process and vetting proposals. And one of the things that he does in the book, which is really important, is to explain that there is no monolithic UNESCO. And so when we say UNESCO is doing this, I mean, UNESCO is an incredibly complex bureaucratic entity, and it's really comprised of its member states. So all the different member states are part of what UNESCO is. And so it's a really complicated story. So I can tell you in the Malawi case, it's kind of interesting because I'm losing track of what your question was, but a big part of it is financial, right? There's a lot of people hope that by getting their item up there, that somehow they're going to get resources for that cultural practice. So in the case, in the Indian case that is written about in this book, for the Kutiyama, I'm not going to get the dance. It's a dance form from the Kerala region. They did, because they got the UNESCO recognition and a lot of money came in through the Indian state to create institutes and training and support for the dance form. In the Malawi case, Malawi is an extremely poor country and they dedicate very, very little money to the cultural sector. So the amount of resources that came for the cultural form was pretty limited. So there's a small exhibit in a small museum in the Northern District about Vimbuza. There was a Vimbuza dance festival. My colleague, Professor Boston Soko, mm-hmm. is writing a book about it. Mm-hmm. But none of that really, none of that goes to the performers themselves. And in my case, it's a little more tricky because the performers aren't performers. They're actually they're medical practitioners, mm-hmm. so it's not really a dance, and so that complicates things too.
And if for folks who are kind of unfamiliar with the dance, could you describe it? Could you provide a little bit of context?
So one of the ironies, or one of the interesting things about this particular form being one of the two items on the list, I think there are three now, but there were two at the time that I was writing, is that Vimbuza is not considered to be a dance. It's not a dance. It's not for entertainment. What Vimbuza is a ritual that is used in the diagnosis of different kinds of ailments and in the treating of the ailments. So you have healers who are infected with Vimbuza, it's connected with the spiritual realm, and it's through movement, which looks like dance. They have special clothing items on. They're moving their bodies. There's rhythm. There's singing. All of those things that we might call music and dance that look like entertainment are not done for entertainment. They're done because it's through that movement and musical practice that the spirits come up in the healer. And so when they're moving and shaking and singing, what they're doing is communicating with the spirit world. And it's through that process that they're able to diagnose illness.
It's by necessity,
and treat it. So one of the ironies and one of the things, so I interviewed several healers, is that if you're going to safeguard this cultural form, and the way that a lot of the safeguarding happens with these forms on the UNESCO list is things like, hey, let's have a festival. Hey, let's have a museum exhibit. Hey, let's have performances. Well, you can't perform a ritual for an audience. I mean, you can't, you know, the spirits aren't going to show up so that you can, like, entertain people. And it's a dangerous space. I mean, bad things happen during the rituals for the, you know, it's people are sick and it's not a happy-go-lucky, hey, we're dancing, let's all play. So one of the ironies is that a lot of the healers feel that if they go and perform at a festival, you know, it's like if they were to go and basically try to do the same thing that they do when they're possessed by the spirits, if they do it at a festival, the idea would be that they would try to do the same thing without the spirits there. They believe that all of their movement and everything they're doing is because the spirits are in them. So you can't just stand up and start shaking and doing these things without the spirits there. So there's some people that are not healers who will perform Vimbusa as a dance for entertainment. Mm-hmm. And the healers think that's really bad because they feel like they're, I mean, it'd be like somebody in the U.S. who's not a preacher getting up and pretending to preach because that's entertainment, mm-hmm. but not actually preaching and not actually connecting with God or, you know, whatever. So it's just a really weird, it's a weird choice of item to, in some ways. But on the other hand, because, and the other thing is it's a very contested practice. So a lot of people, Malawi is a very Christian country, and especially the region that Vimbusa is in, a lot of people think it's like the title of my piece is Demonic or Cultural Treasure, because a lot of people think it's demonic and it's the work of the devil and nobody should do this. And then people who are really into Western medicine think, well, this is bad because people are sick, and instead of going and getting the Western medicine that they need, they're going to the traditional healers and trying to dance it off. And so there's a lot of controversy around the practice, which then again raises the issue about the safeguarding. And in my research, it was interesting because some of the people who were involved in getting it up there wanted it on the list specifically for those reasons. They wanted to legitimize it. They wanted people to say, hey, you know, there is a spiritual realm. This is an important cultural form. This is a healing. We need to stop attacking it. And maybe if it gets this international recognition, people will validate it and value it.
Maybe we can preserve it. But as you were saying before, I mean,
well, ironically, it doesn't need preservation. It's alive and well. And so that's the other issue, is that what is selected to be safeguarded isn't necessarily things that are in any kind of danger, which mm-hmm. goes back to my initial question of people saying culture is dying, and then, you know, what is it that's being safeguarded? So there's kind of a disconnect between people's concerns about cultural degradation versus what is being targeted for safeguarding.
Mm-hmm. What actually, quote unquote, needs safeguarding.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, as a last question, what do you think after editing this and putting together all the essays, I mean, what is the main thing or the main few things that you want folks who read it to get out and academics who read it to get out of the book? And what kind of further study could be done to mm-hmm. push forward this research?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of work being done on intangible cultural heritage, UNESCO policy and practices, and a lot of it is really smart. A lot of it is very critically engaged. You know, I think that I would hope that there would be different audiences and that the different audiences would get different things out of it. And I think if you don't do this kind of research, it seems like kind of a great thing. Like, ta-da, there's these lists. We can go to these countries. I mean, the tourism is a big goal of these lists. And that's a problem in some ways, because if there are some cultural forms that are intended for an outside audience and some mm-hmm. that aren't. And so, you know, I think that I would hope that people would think a little bit more critically about the process. I mean, from my perspective, you know, I would love it to have more of an applied outcome. So there's the scholarly outcome where we all kind of go study and criticize everything, and we're good at doing that. But it would be really helpful. And some of this is definitely happening. And there was a lot of thought that went into the UNESCO convention and the processes, and really a lot of really, you know, good people thinking and asking difficult questions. But I just, you know, one of my own interests is thinking about how does our research of the really trying to understand what's going on the ground, how can that inform future, how policies and processes are made? And, you know, I would love for there to be a more ground up process for items to be recognized mm-hmm. that really were coming from communities and in a more participatory way, which is the intention of the convention, but it's not necessarily how it's happening. Well, so there's part of it that's a big intention of the convention. So I'm sorry, it's kind of a complicated question, so I'm trying to keep focused. So yeah, I think my personal, what I would like is to see it lead to some to maybe some more careful thinking about what would be processes mm-hmm. that would be better, that would be more relevant, and that would speak more directly to the concerns and needs of people on the ground that the convention is intended to serve. Mm-hmm.
thank you so much. This is Lisa Gilman, once again, is an associate professor with the University of Oregon's Folklore Program, and she's the co-editor of UNESCO on the Ground, Local Perspectives on Global Policy for Intangible Cultural Heritage. And that's also co-edited by Michael Dylan Foster. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was an honor.
This has been Crossings Radio, a production of the University of Oregon UNESCO Crossings Institute for Conflict-Sensitive Reporting and Intercultural Dialogue. For more information on Crossings Radio, visit unesco.uoregon.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. And thanks to our partners at UNESCO for that clip at the beginning.